Hello, and welcome back to our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is our special live kind of Discord interactive edition. So if you are live with us and you want to partake in some of the conversation or add to the conversation, or even ask us questions about what we're talking about to get more in depth on certain topics, feel free to join our Discord specifically for this. I think you might see the links or something in the notes for this go-to meeting setup. But last episode, we covered the Know Thy Environment, where we really hit on the inventory of the telemetry profiling data sets, what that looks like from like a data dictionary perspective, and the type of mapping of fields, and then kind of hunting concepts that could be related to that. We're hopefully going to hit more of the baselining, more so because we kind of ended where we were touching on it, but we didn't get into all the things that we kind of already had set up to talk about just because we had so much to cover. So this is kind of our part two of that. But a quick introduction before we really dive into it. I'm Scott Poley. I'm a principal threat hunter at Intel 471 and partake in all sorts of security endeavors throughout my career. So I like to just talk about stuff in general because I've always tried to solve so many different types of problems. And then I'm joined with Tom Kostura. And Tom, you want to give a quick introduction to yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Scott. Hello, everyone. I'm Tom Kostura. Like Scott, I am a threat hunter here at Intel 471, primarily focused on that side, building out contents, new hunts, digging, you know, really living in the weeds. It's where I'm passionate about. I love that stuff. Long time. Man, it feels like forever now, Scott. We've been doing this stuff, not just the podcast, but just being in the field here. And no, it's awesome. These are the shows we get to talk shop and we kind of get to let loose a little bit on topics that we both really enjoy discussing. So, yeah, looking forward to the show.
So this is the first time anyone's joined the live specific editions. We usually try to start with what we call the interesting artifacts, and it's based on resources that may be most likely tailored to the topic at hand. But they're hopefully resources that people can use from like an open source information that might be beneficial, or tools that people can check out that might help them either grow in their security field, or tools they can use to actually solve problems potentially. So I'll start with mine, Tom. If you want to pull those up, there's two I'm kind of sharing, but they're kind of related. So the first thing I kind of came across, because we're talking about baselining and kind of how you profile specific things, you know, we'll get into a little more, but sometimes you kind of have baselines you have to observe, right? You kind of look at what happens in your environment, but sometimes you have that prescribed where like, this is how things are supposed to behave, right? It's kind of determined by policy and configuration and things like that. So this resource, it's called a scuba goggles, right? It's actually given by CISAGov, but it really focuses a lot on the Google Cloud environment, but there's different like configurations. So it has like the calendar, how you do the chat, there's classrooms, the Google Drive, Gemini, but it's all these types of configurations that you can basically run through and consider from a security perspective. And also there's like flags for, is this something that you can test against? Is this something, and what requirements, if there's like specific gov requirement type stuff as well, but like, are there checks you can do to see how things are configured? And you know, I thought this was interesting because a lot of times people may not know what is the best practice approach or what kind of configuration parameters exist, especially for a really large, very future rich type of technologies, like you think of the cloud or, you know, the Google workspace and things like that. So I thought it was just a great resource to be able to reference and might help understand what are some of like the baseline policies you might want to consider, right, when we talk about baselining. So that was like a one piece there. And then the other one, it was an Intune admin. So if people aren't familiar with Intune is kind of Microsoft's way of doing device management. They have many tools previously, but Intune's more of the larger tool, especially if you're using some of the Microsoft Cloud resources to help manage even on-prem stuff with it. But basically, their configurations are like profiles almost you can put in Intune to govern or manage things that way. And those are kind of cool too, because you're able to see how, like maybe how Microsoft Edge is managed, or Windows 11 when you talk about, and there's Linux benchmarks, there's browser benchmarks as far as like, if you have specific configurations for Chrome and things to consider, on how to block or do certain things. And, you know, there's, it looks like there's works in progress as well. So even on the main page, it talks about like what's coming. I think there's like a Firefox profile for how to, you know, set up configurations for that. So like, once again, another good resource that helps you potentially have things that can be leveraged, things that you can kind of learn what controls exist, what behaviors maybe people are actually thinking about. Because a lot of times when you see things being locked down, I think it's helpful to understand what other security professionals consider a risk and why they want to potentially lock things down. I get a lot of food for thought that way, right? On, oh, they put this control in place and I can potentially see how that could be leveraged or bad, or I didn't even think that as a vector, you know, that we would need to lock that down type of things. Or I don't know much about this technology, and based on these things, I kind of have an idea of what this technology is capable of because of the controls that are put into place. So there's like a lot to learn, I think, from some of these things. And if it gets really hard for baselining or profiling your environment because it is the Wild West, sometimes putting good baseline type configurations or prescribed baselines, as I call them, can really help go a long way. So, Tom, I know I kind of walked through a lot of this stuff, but, you know, kind of the stuff covered here, what are your kind of your thoughts on this specific resource when you kind of were checking it out?
Well, I think it's, I think both of them are really awesome from a perspective of, I need to set policies. I need to think about my configuration baselines for these areas. What do I do? I don't know where to start. You have, this is like a really cool repo of like ways to hit off the ground and get going, ways to see what other people are thinking and how they're, what they're thinking about. I think it's awesome. This is, these ones are going to get bookmarked by me just for future potential need. I mean, these are pretty cool.
Yeah. All right, so what do you got for us?
In a similar thinking, we, you know, preparing for the show and thinking about knowing your environment, my brain went immediately to what tends to be a hot topic conversation nowadays with AI, right? So I'm thinking know your environment, and like we feel pretty strong with our experience that we can talk through a lot of the different data sets from a lot of the different types of devices. AI is kind of new, right? All the agentic tooling, all the different things that are out there. And I stumbled across this tool called PipeLock that I hadn't heard about before. Maybe others have. But basically it is a open source like AI, agentic AI firewall. It kind of acts like almost like an MCP proxy. It has a bunch of functionalities. It's pretty neat, but basically it sits detached from your AI agent and inspects the egress traffic, and it has a pretty strong emphasis on expanding on the verifiable egress traffic. So what it wants to do, what it attempts to identify is, let me see, I pulled this one up, kind of looking at the, there's a table that kind of gives a quick overview. It's not just trying to enforce a block or act like a, you know, a firewall just to allow or deny. It's not just trying to look at a proxy to see what's happening. It's trying to do both, which is pretty cool. So when you see some of the examples that they showed in here, and there's just really cool little demo guy here. I'm going to just throw this up, give it a look, a little demo to kind of show you, give you an overview of what it looks like. You basically have, you know, the human interacting on in the chat, the agent doing its thing, the traffic going, the egress traffic going, and then the PipeLock tool sitting in there to see what's happening. So, you know, sniffing out things like, you know, maybe they're trying to, in Base64 encode a secret that's being, you know, shipped off of the agent. Somebody's on the agent to go, it can inspect that, it can stop that, it can look for curl commands, pulling down payloads. It does a lot of cool things. So just something that was interesting. I just started digging on this very recently. I want to dig more because I think it's cool. The repo itself is quite robust. There is a whole lot of information in this, probably one of the more detailed repos that I've seen in a while. But yeah, I just thought it was a pretty cool tool. What'd you think, Scott?
Yeah, so I know, like, especially with MCP servers becoming more popular and being leveraged, as well as there's not like a great like security standard baseline in a lot of ways for MCP servers. And I know one of the challenges when we've talked about, like, well, how do we like hunt for specific, you know, malicious use of MCP servers or how that looks. And one of the challenges is like, well, what data do you have to look at? And some MCP servers, there's I've seen or seen the configurations where you can do some logging or good collection of data. And I was looking at, you know, just the demo they show where they kind of show the chat and then like the detection and then the block or whatever from the agent side. And just curious, like, this might be also a great place where there's enough data there for you to potentially kind of hunt across the data, even for things that may be allowed, right? So there's some opportunities just to have a good centralized way to potentially manage a problem that might be more black box to most. So I always think about those things, which, you know, that'd be really cool if this kind of lends to that approach. Because usually that's when we have these unknown problems, the first challenge is, well, where's the right data to help solve it? And then you can kind of go from there. So yeah, it's kind of a cool approach. It kind of, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you think about like web applications and things, and we developed WASP to help really control and prevent people from taking advantage of web applications or doing weird things with them, interaction wise. I mean, this whole like agentic or MCP type, server approach for performing these types of actions, it's almost like a WAF for that. And so if it didn't exist today like it does here, I've imagined it would be coming out anyways, because I think it's probably one of the similar approaches we've seen with other things, right? So very cool.
That's pretty cool. I like one of the emphasis the right word for that. The emphasis is put on the whole having the receipt at the back end of the action, which is really cool, right? A lot of times you'll see tools that will take an action, block something, stop something, but you don't really know the information that led it up to that point. Usually you have to lead into some kind of a investigation to figure out what happened there. And it kind of does its thing, but ships off that receipt for you to do something with later or to leverage for hunting later, as you mentioned. And that was pretty cool. All right.
Yeah, so a quick recap for what we kind of talked about last time that kind of leads into this. You know, one, we touched a lot on logging and kind of the verbosity that we can run into from a security practitioner of how much you collect. And having logs is not the same as understanding telemetry, right? We touched on, you know, profiling your data that you have, you know, what fields, you know, what null type fields you have, whether data doesn't exist, but it could. How timestamps can affect things, the volume and the parsing of data. We even like spent some time talking about data dictionaries and how sometimes you can use that to help preserve some knowledge so that, you know, tribal knowledge doesn't become your like de facto way because it doesn't really scale a lot of times. And then, you know, the telemetry, like the hunt context loop where you kind of have that baseline. So then, you know, kind of where to pick up from. So, you know, to kind of kick this off, we really want to focus on, you know, what are the specific targets for things that we may consider? So what exactly are we trying to baseline? The data, hopefully like the sources and fields that may be the most reliable for some of that work. Understanding and talking about kind of internal processes that can affect a lot of type of baselining things and things that maybe people should be considering. And then there's kind of some approaches, right, to how people baseline. We'll talk through some of those things. And then different things that, you know, that fool you, right, that potentially causes issues that a lot of people run into with either using baselines trying to build baselines, right? And then how hopefully hunting can kind of unlock, or you can unlock hunting opportunities in general. So, yeah, I mean, when we talk about, you know, baselining your environment, right? You know, if I were to say baseline environment, what would be your first like overall jump to take on that from your perspective?
Well, if you said, hey, baseline the environment, okay. to what end? What am I doing? Why am I baselining? So that's really kind of the first question. So what am I baselining for? What's the point? I can take all the data I have in my environment and create some kind of a baseline around it in some direction, but what am I going for? So if I'm from a hunter perspective, I want to understand, back to the tie to the first show with the Know the Environment, I want to baseline the things that I know I need to watch. I know I need to pay attention to. I want to understand the norms. I want to, you know, not just understand how often users log into a given thing, but what's the structure around that look like? So is there time of day type application that could matter for a baseline around that? What kind of footprint do I have that's exposed to the internet, right? I want to understand that. I want to create a baseline around how that looks, what that traffic looks like. I mean, you can go on and on and on. So it's kind of like, so what goal do you want to achieve? So when I think about baselining, I want to do it purposefully. I know, and we'll probably touch on some of this down the topics, but you know, we have horror stories of baselining with no intent, baselining without establishing a why, right? And then you end up becoming or fall into the circular headache that just is a repeatable headache, just a migraine constantly, because you're trying to follow this baseline that wasn't established with the why. It was just something that was established, kind of pulled out of thin air, you know? So yeah. The first thing, just from my experience at least, when I hear baselining, or I'm saying, hey, go baseline this, I need to marker my why first, so I know exactly what I'm going for. So when I do create a baseline, or I start to try to create a framework to have these baselines sit in, they're purposeful. I understand why they're there. So if I have to change them, I know what to change. I know what to do. I know which direction to go. I mean, from the surface, that's my first thought.
Yeah, I think like when I think of the baseline, sometimes it helps like thinking about the failure states in a way. Like, what if I don't do these things? What do I run into? So they're like, you know, having no baseline, obviously everything is going to look weird or scary, right? When you think about like operationally, how do you deal with alerts and events and, you know, what you're going to do with the data? And then like the fake baseline. And I know a lot of times the struggle people talk about with baselining things, it's like, oh, you know, we baseline something and then it's stale, right? They talk about that. But I also think there's a fake baseline that we develop as analysts, especially if we're dealing with things on a day-to-day.
Where, almost like a tribal knowledge thing, right?
Yeah, like I've seen this alert 1,500 times and it's always, if it has this in it or whatever, I immediately say it's nothing. And it may be accurate, but it kind of is a fake baseline because it's not really validated to the degree that you would say, I would put this in a document or something, right? You know what I mean? Or you don't. So there's some of those like traps that I think people can fall into, but this is where I think people run into is people try to sometimes use baselining for like anomaly detection, or like, hey, if anything outside of this baseline, it means bad, right? But anomaly detection really is something that produces alerts specifically. A baseline's, I like this phrasing, is really there to produce judgment, right? How do I take basically knowledge that's captured so that when I see something compared to that, I can say, I can see how this could be normal. I can see how this could be a problem, or I can see how there's some other questions or things that we need to ask and what to ask based on that, right? Basically, it's like approaching a problem with previous knowledge versus just approaching a problem with completely fresh eyes and no understanding. So I really like that distinction. That's kind of the first thing I've seen.
Go ahead. Is it best to say that the anomaly detection lives on top of the baseline? Is that safe to say? Because I could absolutely see how you'd use baselining for anomaly detection, but the baseline itself isn't the anomalous detection. It's just, you know, I feel like again, the why. Why do you have this baseline?
It's like the guardrails, right? Like you can sit there and say the baseline determines what we want to detect. But when it comes to, because, you know, if you try to build detections that completely pair off your baseline, don't you kind of end up with a lot of false positives a lot of times, right? Where you're like, okay, I mean, like we got this really tuned into the baseline, and it's like, but we constantly have these false positives that we're like dealing with or shelling off, depending on the activity. Obviously, like there's a lot of, depending on what you're baselining, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But so what we're trying to, I think, really target in on some of the things are, you know, there's five concrete classes of things to baseline that I think people should always How they prioritize what their approach is would be like accounts. You know, we've talked about a little bit of that in the last time. Endpoints as a, you know, comes to like software, applications, infrastructure, and then critical assets specifically, right? Based on your environment and your business model and things like that. You know, when we talk about the detection piece, how would you, and we talked about the whole like judgment conversation. I think this kind of question kind of comes up. What's the difference between like a baseline and allow list? You know, how would you frame that when you think about that? Like, because sometimes people use a baseline as an allow list, but is that really the right approach? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you set and establish baselines, you can kind of go in any direction again, right? It comes down to the why. So if you're trying to establish a baseline so you understand how to build an allow list, I think that helps you with, I think you were, what you had said about the judgment piece. Your baseline helps you get to that point of deciding what value you're going to get out of this. But doing it specifically for that, I don't know, to me, like if you were just building a baseline to find a way to build an allow list or to just, you know, check one specific type of thing, you're basically like falling into that trap of creating that baseline for detection. And that's not what you want. What you want to do is understand your environment, right? The whole main topic, you want to go after it and know what this stuff does, not just for your point in time need, but scope it to where you can leverage this understanding of your environment in its entirety, not just, okay, Steve's account is normally only logs in four times. It's suddenly logged in five. Oh, sky's falling, yeah. Right? Like we know right. What those look like. And that's where, like, if you talk about baselining and that's how you leverage it, you're failing yourself. Like that's, I don't think that's what baseline should be. Baseline should give me this running understanding of how the blood's flowing through the veins of my network, right? Or through a given endpoint or through an account layout or an account attack surface or, you know, anything you kind of go to baseline. You want to kind of have it a living, breathing thing, not a point in time thing that's going to set some median for you to just make a decision now. It needs to live and breathe. I think that's where people tend to go south with baselines. And I almost feel like throughout, because we've crossed some of this before in different scenarios for different things, where the idea of leveraging a baseline to help us achieve a goal would come up, and we would try to generate these baselines to do this thing we needed to do. But then you get this where that baseline doesn't live and breathe. You achieve the thing in the point in time you needed to do, but now this thing's throwaway. But a lot of effort went into that baseline, but you only did it for this one little small reason, right? And you end up kind of shooting yourself in the foot because you're not thinking about it from the from the onset to, I want this to live and breathe. I want to understand my environment. I don't want to just accomplish this one goal or this one policy or compliance measure or this one detection or this one anomaly. I want to think about a baseline as something much different than that. I think that's what you're thinking, Scott. I don't know. Yeah. What do you think?
I mean, I feel like it's kind of like how you look at and measure your baseline that kind of answer a lot of those questions, right? Because you know, you can measure things based on, you know, how frequent something is or the volume of something, how unique certain things are, maybe the timing or relationships or sequence of events even sometimes can help you determine, hey, this is, seems to be normal. Now this is abnormal. But then the how you look from like a, what you compare against, you know, there's a few different ways when you compare, like are you comparing against past behavior, which is, it's great. It can be a really strong signal for there's a change. But if you don't have historical data, not helpful. Peers is really good, right? Because you can sit there and say there's a similar account or person or device, or, you know, there's a cluster of like devices that share the same responsibility, whatever that looks like. And so then you can sit there and make that defensible when you want to say something's out of the norm, but it requires a lot of like context from like asset inventory or HR data and things like that. So it's not just like usually transparent in the data itself, right? It requires some enriching. And then there's the global where like, hey, you know, we don't think service accounts should ever have interactive logins. Probably true if your environment's configured and you have those prescribed baselines that we kind of mentioned earlier. But does that mean that it's the strongest signal? Not necessarily, because it's environment specific. And you know, you run into like the what does noise look like? And there's kind of different shapes of normal. It's kind of how it's defined, right? You've got like a stable environment, right? Whereas low variance, pretty flat. And you look at like ICS environments, you know, I imagine this should in most cases be somewhat stable. You look at like certain types of service or application accounts should be somewhat stable, right? But then you also have like cyclical, right? Where there's certain things that follow patterns based on time of year or, you know, week, off hours, on hours, those types of things. Then you have like the bursty stuff, like deployments and backups and scans that can happen, right? It could be a shape of normal, but, you know, looking at it blindly might look abnormal. And then you kind of have like the drifting stuff, like cloud environments usually follow this because there's certain things about where resources come from. And, you know, with SaaS application, potentially it's stuff can drift on you. And then you just have like some places are just chaotically normal, which is tough. Like you think, you know, we talk about supply chain attacks all the time with developers. They're always potentially testing or doing new things. So that you always see a net new, but it's kind of like their role, right? So statistical baselines don't really work well in that environment. So you got to be kind of thoughtful in what you're looking at. And so, yeah, that's why we get to that whole like observed versus prescribed, right? Because if even some of those things that are bursty or chaotic, if there's still some of that prescribed, like the configuration stuff we talked about, I think it makes it easier to come up with what would be a sensible, usable baseline as well. It's kind of what I was thinking in terms of that. But yeah, so I would say, you know, when we talk about this, the five shapes, right, to kind of reiterate of those, which one of those from just your past you think has caused you the most pain?
Oh, all of them? No, the I think the ones that tend to be a pain and cause the most catch up to understand and put out imaginary fires are the bursty type things, right? Like when you have, you know, you might have a simpler flat environment, but then you have some level of updating happens. Like updates are a huge trigger to throwing off your baselines, right? Because they could come at any given time, depending on the thing that's being updated, right? You can have stuff that's out of band. You could have things that are configuration type updates that need to go out to like critical systems, maybe out to like your ICS type environment. You could have out of band patching that has to occur, you know, the bursty stuff that comes with things like that, you know, different uploads, sometimes people making major like AD changes that start really kind of blowing your baseline out, depending on if it touches on that specific baseline for that why. But I can remember a lot of times where, you know, we'd be in a situation where we thought we had a baseline understood, and we had a lot of like netting around that to look for things relative to that baseline. And then these bursty items happen, and now you're spending this time trying to understand what it all is, right? So you're distracted from what you're trying to accomplish because you're dealing with this burst that just blew up what you thought your baseline was, you know? That one I can think of so many times that we've ran into trouble for that.
Yeah. And I feel like it's because for whatever reason, from like an operational perspective, even if it's not security yet, noticing the burst, someone notices a burst, right? And that immediately is the most visible thing. And that's been the biggest, I think that's when you talk about shapes of normal, the biggest distraction. That we're probably thinking of similar instances that we both lived through. Based off that, right? Where it's like we're being sidetracked for, hey, why did we have all this data go this direction? Because we're looking at data flow, or why are we seeing this like a surge on blocks on this whatever, or you know, or there's all these like offs that happen, and you're like, yeah. And then when you look at it, it is very normal. It's just not something you see on an everyday window. So it's like it's outside normal for that quick snapshot, right?
So I have a question alongside of that for you, because I'm curious what your take is now, because I know mine has changed over time.
Okay.
When we talk about baseline and then figuring out like, you know, the shapes around the baselining, what do you think is enough data? I know there's variables because we're not specifically talking about a given thing we're baselining. We're talking about baselining overall, but in general, on average, what do you think is the amount of data you need to establish a confident baseline to achieve even the most basic goal you could think of in your head as to why you would build a baseline? Like, how much data would you need? How many days or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question, but I feel like my core approach is what entity type am I trying to baseline? Because that kind of already frames that a little bit. And then out of the data that I actually have, in what way can I tie data to that entity? Like by its IP address, by its own specific logs based on if it's like an application. Do I have visibility? What in those can tell me certain things? Because if there's not a lot of information there, or there's only particular information there, I might baseline different things about it, right? And then that kind of determines duration. Like if there, for instance, is a lot of data on like one topic about that entity or asset or whatever it is, I might not need a lot of days. But if it's kind of one of those quiet types, right, where you kind of have maybe a steady stream, but it's just not like, maybe I want more time. But that's always like you kind of do with what you got, for instance. But ultimately, if you end up asking more questions you can't answer based on what you're trying or how your approach to baselining, that's when I think you like look at adjusting those. Cause I think that's like a moving scale. But sometimes if you can answer the question easily with very little or what you got, or feel confident and, you know, you can then kind of validate that with a little bit more time. That's great, right? That's like the best case scenario. It just gets weird when I know the problem you probably are alluding to, where you think you have something nailed, and then as time goes by, you realize it's off and you're adjusting and adjusting and adjusting. And then you're like, well, what did we do wrong to begin with? And it's just like this moving target. It can kind of feel like, but the one thing that you gain regardless, as long as it doesn't completely saturate your entire role, is you're learning a lot about your environment, just yourself. And it might you might not necessarily address the specific problem you set out to address, but you're likely solving other problems along the way or getting new ideas for, you know, getting your grips on other things. So it's not necessarily like lost time. It's just sometimes some things are easy to baseline and some things aren't. Like when we get to the account stuff, which I think we can probably jump into a little bit. Let's see some of the notes. So like, with accounts, there's a lot of things to consider, right, on how users work, because you have like standard users or privileged users or admins. And does your environment call those accounts out, right? Is it easy to identify based on the account naming convention, or do you have to just know based on enumerating some sort of groups? But you can even have other tiers of like developer or an executive, so that you know they're like high value based on that, or they're a contractor. Being able to understand how these accounts exist, test accounts, break glass emergency accounts, all really important. But I always bring up service accounts as a good example, because there should be more predictable patterns there potentially. And I went through kind of like my own process and like, well, what would I do to try to enumerate service accounts? And there's a couple of ways to do it, but it's not foolproof, right? I'll share. I'm assuming I can put the code base in Discord so it's easy to see. But there are like SPNs, service principal names. If you register an account in AD to run a service somewhere, it can get an SPN associated with it. So in AD, you can like look for that. The problem is that's not necessarily all the service accounts. Because if someone uses their account to set up a scheduled task or something like that, that's kind of a service account mechanism you'd want to understand there. And then there are other like default groups within Microsoft that could be considered a service account. And then you got to figure out, well, what does that look like with the MSAs and GMSAs, right? They're managed service accounts. It's kind of just managed by Microsoft. AD type stuff. And then if So then you start building this list of what is a service account, but then you also look for like non-interactive logons. So like there's type 4 and type 5. And we talked about the context before when looking at login data. Like type 4 is batch. So basically associated with scheduled tasks or batch processing. And then type 5 is service, right? It's a create when an account is used to start a Windows service. So, you know, then you can kind of build on, well, what accounts outside of that first list are can I add to based on that? And then you can look at like password configurations. If you're able to, you know, query AD and say, what accounts have a different password expire policy? Because usually service accounts traditionally are set up because it's a pain, especially if they're important, to roll passwords quickly. So they might have a different password roll schedule, like annually maybe, or every 6 months. So then you can kind of like pull accounts based off of that, right? And then you can look at delegations. And then there's certain like core Microsoft memberships, if it's like domain admins or backup operators or server administrators, you know, there's some groups that maybe help you enumerate some of those things. So as you can see, like even just trying to get your base, or I want to just like look at this population of things, isn't necessarily always easy. And then you think about this, that everyone's environment is slightly different. But I think it's important to go through those exercises, right? Because you highlight a lot of things about either how much control you have or people have in your environment in general and how much control they don't. And you'll learn a lot about your environment through the process. When you talk about baselining, sometimes it's just knowledge you might gain versus something you can apply. But it's better to know these problems or are potential value adds going into any of your investigations, going into any of your content type building, your threat hunting. That's when you start becoming a value add security practitioner in your environment because of that context you're creating for yourself. So yeah, like it's crazy because, you know, in my head I'm thinking, well, service accounts are probably the easier one to deal with. I mean, I think what I described could make it very complicated, right?
Yeah, could get messy. That's one of the things that's interesting too when you consider the baselines with like policies or security controls that are in place. If you're considering doing baselines, you want to at least be aware of what security controls are in place, right? But you don't want to make them gospel because those security controls could be skated, right? You could get around them.
Yeah,
you could potentially find stuff that's not adhering to these controls that could be a giant gap that you need to cover. You need to kind of like bring both together. But I do think understanding what security controls are in place when you're doing baselining and, you know, potentially what kind of policies are in line can help you focus on, be more accurate with your aim towards how you're developing your baseline, right? Like it won't be exact, but you can say, okay, I know I have less worry on this bar. I'm going to shrink in it a little bit and get my baseline more focused while still considering this, still learning their environment, like you said. Because me personally, when you're doing baseline stuff, some people I think it's a headache. It seems like a stressor. I think it's awesome. I love anytime you can look at all the different things that are happening in environments, stare at the data, understand the telemetry, understand how the workflows and everything's going on. You're never not going to learn from that. And it's just going to make you so much better, like you said. But I just wanted to make sure that point was mentioned, because I think considering those security controls alongside your effort to baseline is very important, because you need to understand your environment in that sense too. So you can just be accurate. And then your baseline is going to live longer, to be completely honest. You're going to let that thing breathe more because it's going to already be kind of fit to do that, because you've considered the rest of things happening to give you more focus and you can get more benefit.
Yeah, I think having like baselining seems more like a chore until you have at least a good set of skills or tools to just make it easy to look at data, right? Then it becomes, I think, also more enjoyable, because I know like now I've acquired a way, it's like, oh, if I want to like group certain things together and I have like, I can create visuals, even just like dumping some things in Excel or whatever across stuff that I've kind of acquired. It does make like looking at things and outliers and stuff maybe easier to build that understanding faster. So it's not as much of a chore. So, I mean, that's just something you grow with, or sometimes there's tools that you might have that help with that, right? But
you don't miss the bays of just getting a raw CSV and trying to figure out what things...
I think that's why I probably developed a lot of these skills, right? Like,
yeah, necessity. Yeah,
we got a problem here. Can you tell me what's going on? I'm like, I don't even know what I'm looking at. You know, like, let me play with the data. But one of the things when I was kind of researching and looking at what other people are doing from a baselining perspective that I really liked was, and something I never thought about, was maintaining a calendar. And I'm like, what would you maintain a calendar for? But it was like every time something happens, when we talk like those bursts or talk about like whatever the activity, a calendar of those weird normal events. So you have something to kind of reference, well, what's the cadence of this look like? What does, you know, did we ever see this in the past for anything kind of big? And I thought that was like an interesting approach. Now, granted, like if your environment's like crazy noisy, it just becomes another really noisy data source. But with the concept that you kind of have a good grasp on most things and know what to do, and then you have those like oddball things that happen once in a while that you're like, what is this? And then you're like, oh yeah, okay, we know what that is now. We investigated it. Just so you're aware of these kind of things. And it's really good, I think, for people that are new to environment, if they have something like that, they can look back and say, what is our environment? How does our environment operate in general? And what weird things have occurred that I can just like look back 6 months and say, oh yeah, we've had these crazy, we had an outage because of this crazy distribution thing and it looked like this, but we found out it was this, or we had the, you know, whatever. I thought that was an interesting way to like kind of just baseline just operations in a way. That makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
That was kind of fun. So
you saw data dictionaries?
Yeah, we can jump into some data dictionary stuff. Yeah, I'll let you kind of lead into some of that if you want.
Okay. I'll give it a shot. But we did start, I think, the back part of the last episode of the part one of this, talking about data dictionaries, kind of what they look like, what they mean. You know, we didn't go super in the depth. So, you know, really, data dictionaries, I know when we talk about them, sometimes you'll kind of see the unexpressed eye roll. You'll kind of feel that, right? It's kind of almost like, you know, it's like, a good idea.
Sounds great, but do I want to do it?
Yeah, but can we actually make this a reality? And it's, I personally think yes. And I think I've experienced success with folks doing this before. But you got to think about, again, the why. Why are you building this? What is it for? Like, you have to have the purpose ahead of the task. The task, the data dictionary, the purpose is what it's going to be used for. So you can make sure that it does hold value. It's not just some general thing you grabbed out of a dictionary explanation of what a data dictionary is. There's some key things that you might want to consider. So, you know, I don't know that you want to kind of go into a place. Let's talk about a data dictionary that we would leverage as a means for threat hunting or for, you know, maybe a SOC realm. Like what would that look like? Like what would be some of the key fields you'd want to see there? What would be some of the iterations or change that you would expect over time with that data dictionary? You know, I'm sure you have some examples in your mind. I know you've played with these quite a bit too.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, sometimes people always start with like the obvious fields, right? Oh, the username. This is the user that did blah, 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 blah. Or this is IP address. This is, you know, I like to look at the weird data first, you know, and we talk about like certain logs have like additional contextual data. And sometimes it's mapped to something that's explainable and sometimes it's not. You need to like look up what that is. A great example, we talked about it earlier, like log on types for authentication.
Mm-hmm.
Like if those aren't like mapped or explicitly stated within your data when you're looking at it, and you come across that, or maybe it's encryption types on Kerberos, so you know, like, okay, you're getting a hex value, but it actually maps to the level of encryption being used. And so you can say, is something using a weaker encryption at some point, or is everything standard across the board? Like there's values in certain things. A good example, and I really like and I hate it at the same time because I completely get it. Like CrowdStrike is a really powerful tool. And they have a lot of data that's kind of like mapped to like integer values. It helps with performance, right? Because when you search things, the data, the way it's stored, it's all like tied to like numbers that are then like, you know, mapped to actual real values of certain things. And if you don't know what those are mapped to or the significance of even that field, you really miss out on a lot of the value of the data you're even collecting. And not only that, but there might be things that you're like, man, I really wish, you know, it'd be nice to know this. And like, you don't realize you know it because you're staring at a field name that doesn't necessarily make the most sense. And you don't understand what it's actually capturing because you just see like a value versus an explanation. I think those are where data dictionaries for like a threat hunting perspective is hugely valuable. So if you identify like these logs should be maybe associated with what I want, like the hunt I want to run. Like I'm worried, I'm thinking about this type of execution or this type of lulbin or this type of authentication or this whatever, or this behavior in general. And this is the log sources, I believe. And these are the log events, I think, or pertain to that. If there's those extra fields, those are the ones you want to map first, especially for that use case. Because you might come up with a few different approaches to hunt for. Because, you know, we all been down that road where you hunt for something and your results are like, well, this one doesn't really work. But then you like do a variation of that one, or you have like two or three ideas and one of the three works, right? I feel like the more you understand the data, the more options or opportunities you'll have because of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think too, the dictionary thing too, I think a lot of times when you say it or you bring up the notion or you pitch the idea as a project or a task or some kind of an objective, I think a lot of times the frame of thought goes to, okay, well, what are the standards? What are the key things? Like you said, what are the, like, just the user field? What are the, if I go Google what a data dictionary is, can I get a template to start from? And I personally think and have experienced that I think that's where the idea of a usable data dictionary fails. You need to leverage the data you already know. So not the logs per se in your environment, but maybe your old hunts or your old casework from, you know, an alert or an IR incident or something like that. That's where you're going to see the stuff that's important on the finished investigations or the finished hunts or the stuff that you've done. So accessing that to help you kind of establish that dictionary. And again, we're assuming we already know the why in my mind. Like I already know why I want to build this data dictionary. So now I'm going to go at the data sets that are going to help me get to that why. I'm going to use what I've already experienced, what I know, and what I've seen in my environment. And that can get you off and running and having something that's in that positive. Because I think, and, you know, we've talked about this before. If you go out, grab a template, do something like that because you're not sure where to start and you're just kind of on the surface scale, and then you set something and you don't consider what you're doing with it, you don't consider the why, and then at some point it fails you. I think even in our experience, Scott, the immediate reaction is to give up on it and move to something else. And you kind of don't want that, right? You want to make something, if you're going to spend the time doing something, make it purposeful. So yeah, I think a good way really is like, it makes sense. Leverage your data, leverage the stuff you've done to help build these dictionaries out. Don't just go find a template. Don't just dive into the raw logs. Like look at what you've investigated that you've cared about before and start there. Maybe start simple. Build one off of some sure sets of things you constantly investigate, have alerted on, or have had IR incidents with. Take that set of data and say, this is what I want my dictionary to be for this thing. And now you have something really core and solid that's already been proven that you already know would be of value because it would have in those investigations, right?
Yeah, I feel like building the data dictionary is always a chore. And it's always important to do. But the other challenge I feel people run into is like, if you had the baseline, what do you baseline first? You know, always that priority of things. And I think one of the things that I typically think it's really good to be aware of, and sometimes if it's really well created and done, it answers a lot of those questions too. But it's also, there's like a challenge there, which I'll get into, like DR plans or your disaster recovery plans. Like I always feel like when, at least when I started in security and people mentioned the disaster recovery, it just felt like one of those, like, yeah, we have to have one, but you know, it's like, and it's going to have a bring everything online type of a solution. So it just kind of felt like redundant in a way. But I've seen some pretty good disaster recovery plans. And what was kind of cool with some of the plans I've looked at was they call out like dependencies. Like, hey, this is a really critical asset. And for this asset to work, it is dependent on like these five or six things. So now you know, like, oh, this is how things can break too, right? And then what is, so from an impact standpoint, right? If you're talking about defending something, now you got those points of interest that more likely will bring down infrastructure or more likely bring down your like core business application type stuff, right? Which is very impactful to the business, not always what's being attacked, but it's good to have some idea of how those things work as far as like understanding they exist. Do you get data from them to begin with? And is the data useful for, you know, what you think you might do with it? And there's different tiers that consider that in, right? There's like the tier zero, which is like, you know, your identity and control infrastructure. You're talking about like your all your identity access type stuff, your backup infrastructure, endpoint management, a hypervisor, which is an interesting one, right? Like, well, I was reading through a scenario and you talk about baselining. You have like, you don't want data to leave. So you have DLP and you have ways to look at how that looks at data. You have some sort of access control on data, the way it's flagged or who has access to what. And if you see someone go into an hypervisor with the hypervisor management account and then they extract a whole VM and the disk with it, there's none of those controls are going to see that data leaving that way. And from a baseline perspective, it's an account that goes to the hypervisor and it's exporting. So it's not even an abnormal account usage. But knowing, is that even a normal behavior for how does that even happen often, right? In the past, right? And it's like, there's so many ways where someone can completely defeat a lot of the controls you rely on to say, we've got this problem solved. And now someone just did something that was a normal access and took advantage of a capability you might, may or may not have visibility to, right? So that's kind of why we do some of the things that we do. But then you get to like your tier one, your revenue and mission systems that are associated with your business. Tier two is more your sensitive data. It could be compliance related, you know, PHI, PCI, API type stuff, all your data warehouses. And then tier three is where everything else falls from like a tiering model. So you can kind of prioritize things kind of in that fashion. But that, I think my contradiction, I was kind of curious what your thoughts on this is, those are the big ticket items and the things that everyone's like, we need to protect. But I always feel like the small ticket items are what get hit first, and then they impact the big ticket stuff, right? Like a compromise happens, oh, an HR person got phished, and then they laterally moved to X, and then they laterally moved to X, right? And when we think about security practitioners, we always want to be on the forefront and say, we've detected it as soon as possible. So I struggle with the let's focus on the most critical asset piece and also saying, what do we focus on from like the lower level assets? But that's likely what gets hit first from a management perspective. I don't know, like I think you understand my struggle there, but like, what are your thoughts on that?
It tends to be a game of, hot potato a little bit, I think.
It feels
that's
like
the
it,
best
yeah.
analogy. But I think it really comes down to what mechanisms you have in place. So when you talk about like your baselining or previous incidents you've investigated, kind of, you know, continuing down this path of developing this know your environment baseline and what to use and how to navigate left and right of it. A lot of times those critical assets are deemed critical. And I guess circling back, why are they critical? Are they critical for are they business critical assets? But from a cyber perspective, they have little or no chance of actually being leveraged. What are these assets? I think like trying to keep it more of a broad scope where I think we want to live and not just focus specifically on what's deemed a critical asset, but look in between the layers. I think that's I think that has to be absolute. Like we can't just focus on a critical thing because we're going to miss the other things that are going to happen that are eventually going to pop that critical thing, right? Or anything in between. And yeah, I don't know. I remember certain scenarios where it's like, okay, you get hyper focused on this batch of critical assets, and then before you know it, you're catching an uppercut from the side you didn't even bother looking at, or some random device that is sitting in between all these critical assets, but it wasn't deemed critical and it was the entry point, right? Like a scenario like that can happen. So I don't think, like, especially as hunters, or as the incident responders, the security analysts on the side, on the defense side, we can't narrow focus like that. Like, I think it's important to know, though. So when you're baselining, you do want to understand what assets are critical and why they're critical, but you don't want to just hyper focus on them. They just need to kind of have their tier marker, right? Develop some kind of system that says, okay, if this is in play, there's escalation paths that may need to take place, but it doesn't shut down your focus. It just says, if you open this, other lights will go off for different things that we need to consider, right? Like, you can develop your dictionary to fit that schema, right? Like, these things, if you hit this tripwire, there's a couple different actions we need to consider because the criticality might have escalated, or other people may not need to be involved, or business impacts may fall. Like, there's different things, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny because you kind of had a light bulb go off in my head. And I was thinking back to, you know, you learn about risk, and it's like, it's the like likelihood, right? And then I forgot what the other thing that measures with that. But basically, I was always like, you know, when you try to come up with those matrices, like, oh, well, this is a really big impact, but the likelihood is really low, right? And I really feel like risk has to drive some of that baselining approaches, right? Because you know what your overall risk is, and you're like, oh, can someone get into the core switch to shut down all the ports? And now, oh, everything's down. Cool. But the likelihood of that, and when you say likelihood, you're also thinking, what do the attackers really care about? It's usually not like shutting things down that way, right? That doesn't really happen that often. So you say the likelihood is pretty low. Impact could be really high. But like you said, I feel like that usually drives more the priority when you see something on something that's that critical of a device or entity. You respond to it first. Immediately, it takes all your attention, right?
Yep.
But as far as like that baselining practice and the security development, the hunt, you're looking at the most likely things, which sometimes are your like lowest hanging, who cares about this asset, you know, fruit in a way.
Yeah. But it could also, I mean, we're talking on both sides, but I think we can center this for the audience. It could also be that critical device only has like a subset, the critical set of assets only has a subset of ways of hitting it. So you still want to pay attention to those specific things,
right?
You know, I'm thinking out loud here, and I know I'm crossing it, but yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah. I mean, like, I think it's, and that's what's tough is like, how much time do you spend where? You can't ignore it, and we made that obvious. No. But like, sometimes I guess planning, right? If you're planning to do baselines, maybe that's the step where you identify how much time we're going to spend or what are we going to check off. As far as, you know, if we have the time, we circle back and do more potentially, right? But you have to, you know, manage that, and that's where leadership comes into play. And good security leadership helps with some of those things, answering some of those questions. But it's always interesting because I do think DR plans can be helpful. But like I said, it could also be a distraction if you're thinking about critical assets because of the whole likelihood potential there.
But, you know, from a building the baseline perspective, you can get a lot of information from stuff like a DR plan, right? It's the same thing to like understanding the policies and the security controls. The DR plan falls right into that scope.
Yeah, you can understand architecture sometimes better than actually looking at architecture plans because it kind of describes it in layman's term of this relies on this because of this functionality or whatever, right? Not that you see it connected and you're like, oh, I don't know why that matters, right? So
I like the one too that you don't typically see, right? There's like in our show notes, one of the ones we have to talk or we kind of put to potentially talk about. I love this one because this one I think is true to form. And I think we've actually had some experience with this one. From a DR perspective, where your network may have like break glass accounts for emergencies. And they're not accounts that you're typically aware of or you don't see. You may never see them. I think they're never meant to be seen if you don't need them. But the only place that is knowledgeable about them, and maybe those accounts aren't used for a long time, but they sit in a DR plan. So you can understand they exist. So if you see this new thing, if you see, you understand what this account is, you understand what it's for, that really does give you so much meat to help with that baselining piece, like around certain things.
That prescribed baseline almost.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but you know, and then this is another like, I guess tension point for me. So I'm always on the fence on this one as well. So, obviously when people do logging on endpoints and they want to determine baselines, they'll might just collect server logs And you're like, cool, we have like the same logging, and it's usually like things to execute and authentication are the most common things being collected right across devices and endpoints. But then you have like, well, this server is a database, and this server is a web application, and this server is. And so then you start running into like, well, there's extra logs depending on the role of that endpoint, right? That may benefit from being baselined or may benefit from understanding that data. But in some ways, like when we talk about hunting for like web applications being compromised, it's if you have the execution data on the server itself, you can kind of see that without actually seeing the attack, because you can see the post exploitation activity
sometimes.
So like, you know, when you're talking about like, where do you get the most bang for your buck? Do you need all the application logs? Do they answer questions that you need? Like, you know, so then it comes back to that. Well, is the system a high priority or low priority? You know, like what more can you do with it? You know what I mean? So I don't know how that sits with you, because I've always been like, well, if it's a web application, I want to have the web application logs because I can understand what's going on. But from a security perspective, is that as important as just knowing when things get compromised after the fact? Because I have other things that can tell me that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've hit headaches and investigations in the past where, let's say... the most generic terms, let's say there is new crazy zero-day exploit for application X. Application X is commonly used and it's popular, and maybe my environment has application X. Maybe application X requires very specific dedicated assets to allow it to function, right? And then those very specific and dedicated application servers have very generic and very basic telemetry on them, nothing whatsoever from like an audit policy or from a log capture or any telemetry enabled for application X. So now you're in this place where you're trying to hunt 0 day for application X, and you do not have telemetry for application X, even though it definitely exists in your environment, and you kind of get put, you know, behind the belt a little bit there, right? So yeah. You could actually, you know, and I can think too how, you know, from a threat hunting perspective, from this whole practice of developing a baseline, considering all the factors to put together maybe data dictionaries or a usable baseline inside of your threat hunting structure, or maybe your SOC, or you know, the folks that are looking at the activity happening in the environment on a day-to-day, you can kind of drive that increase or that change. You can find those holes. Like we talk about things where you, where threat hunting will identify gaps in telemetry. This is absolutely the same thing, right?
Yeah.
But this goes to more than just that hunt. This goes to understanding that environment piece and where you have kind of a focus area, right? Like if you have a scenario like that, you have this scope that maybe even a baseline just for that scope could be a play, right? Like maybe you have an application that is constantly being exposed, has vulnerabilities on a basis that's uncomfortable, and you just need to have a baseline around them so you can make sure you're in full tip-top shape to react to things there, to hunt to things there. But yeah, I mean, I'm almost starting to get a little bit of PTSD in my brain for some of the scenarios we've hit with that.
Well,
cause it's like, hey, okay.
So I was kind of thinking as you were talking and looking at some notes here, and it kind of, I think helps scope it better in my mind. Like I mentioned web applications, and we can easily see in most web applications when there's post exploitation for something in a web app based on the core web app process spawning off a lot of like the Lulbin type stuff that we've seen patterns for. Cool. So like that type of class of server or instance or entity, it might solve that way, right? But Citrix, I think it's a great example. There's been so many attacks against Citrix, right? And a lot of times when I've looked at the investigations for if attacks occur, it's looking at Citrix logs, because usually some of the exploits are you get to the box and you have access to parts of the environment Citrix gives you access to that you're not supposed to have, or you're able to get access to data that you're not supposed to have, right? And you can see that from the Citrix log because of the context that's there with the auth that happens and with the actions that it records that you can't see from a standard server, right? Even though it might be running on maybe a server if it's the Citrix app or something. I forgot how they install those. I think there's probably multiple ways. But I think that's like a good example of like why data dictionaries are important, because you can data dictionary what the extra data is from applications, and does it enrich the data you already get from the servers that be beneficial or not at that cross compare. So, I think that's kind of the know thy environment kind of comes into play there, right? Like, what do you baseline? What do you collect? And why? You got to be able to kind of understand those things. So that's kind of a good piece there.
So go ahead.
No, go ahead.
If you had to right now say an average environment, you're going to go after a baseline and you're going to start talking about key things that you want to think about there, or, you know, building a data dictionary, really just you're going to start to execute what we've talked about to this point. Right. What would be the thing you would go after first? Would it be specific machines? Would it be accounts? Would it be, you know, software? Would it be specific applications? Like, what would be a thing that you would directionally go after if you were sitting down, understanding everything we've already talked about to this point? Now you're ready to make a move. What are you going after?
So, I mean, I would try to, if sitting a square one, I would want to figure out how to prioritize. And for me to figure out how to prioritize, I just want to know like a few things. One, I would probably look at, can I quickly identify a list of service accounts? And what do those look like? And accounts in general, like naming conventions. So I can kind of like, how would I deal with the auth base and activity there? I would look at execution type stuff across the environment. What almost like an asset inventory for like software that's being run. And then I would still apply like attack knowledge, right? Like what kind of scripting, like command, like let's say it's a Windows environment, like what kind of command prompt, PowerShell, whatever activity in general goes on. Because that helps scope what do I want to focus on first. And if it's like everybody in the environment uses PowerShell, cool. I may focus on something outside of just execution in general and focus on what do these users do, what are their roles, that kind of stuff. If I'm looking at, you know, what's the business purpose or the business I look at, and it's like, oh, we're like an eBay, right? We just have this huge, you know, commerce web app. So I'd be really focused on like, what's connected to those types of front end infrastructure, assuming it's probably going to be in the cloud. So make things a little different, but I would kind of like walk that path and then settle on what are the easiest things first, right? After I get a basic understanding. And then just kind of build off from there, because you kind of have to, it's a problem you chip away at, and it's more about determining where to start, because you know, in my head, I'm like, well, I'd want to do it all, but I understand that's not always the feasible solution.
What if we talk about one that we think is that we tend to hear the most about? So usually when you talk baseline, and one of the first things that I think comes to most people's minds is user accounts or accounts. Do the first five hit list things you go after, right? Because there could be problems there, right? You could have a big environment. How do you enumerate all the accounts? How do you understand what they do and where they do things? Like, how do you understand
I would definitely start with what's prescribed first. So are there policies for how accounts either are getting created or what they're used for? Are there configurations that govern how those accounts are used as well? As far as like groups and stuff like that. So like if there's a policy that says domain admin account should not be logged in anything other than domain controllers, I'd be like, well, that's prescribed. I immediately can say, is that even true? And if I can validate some of those things, and to be completely honest, there might, because there's policies, there might be a team like audit or something like that. It is already making sure that's happening. So you can almost just get that answer immediately without having to do a lot of work, because they're already doing it and they can, you know, prove their results if you need them to prove it, kind of thing. And then you can kind of go from there. But I would definitely start with the prescribed stuff first. And then I would focus on privileged account activity, right? So you have to kind of walk down from like the more critical to the less critical as far as that behavior. The other thing, you know, a lot of people focus on like failed authentications and stuff like that. That's always kind of tough too, because if you collect all stuff, like for instance, if you have some sort of application or something that sits on the outside and things compound against it, whether you set it up that way intentionally or not, even though it probably has some controls or like auto silent drop if thing has failed too many times from a similar source. Collecting data like that can also throw off baselines when you think about like failed auths and successful auths and things like that when you do things in numbers. So you kind of have to, well, do we even want to collect that data? If we know the fail auth, maybe we only want successful auths from certain things that we want to consider in the baseline. So there's those types of decisions. But yeah, things that interact with databases from an account perspective, things that are core service accounts for like big applications in the environment that have a lot of privilege, like backups, for example, because ransomware is a thing, right? So one, you want to make sure that there's no issues with the backup accounts in general so that you can recover if that's your mechanism. And they also have a lot of access to things to be leveraged if they ever get compromised. Domain admins, privilege, database, backups, and then endpoint management type service stuff, since there's a lot of that that goes on, like big environments that are not managed them like a single admin. They have a tool or something in place that does a lot of that, which has a lot of access and control too.
So let me throw you a curveball.
Okay.
Let me throw you a curveball. So when you're considering those things and you live in a point in time, you mentioned all the things that they all make sense. None of that, you know, I can't refute any of that, but we are in this current kind of flow of supply chain attacks and developer focused areas. Would you consider that because of the point in time of the climate, shifting focus or priority to something that you know is happening more often versus something that, you know, would you consider doing that? Like, okay, well, we have these couple down, but maybe we're going to set aside, we're going to prioritize our developers and focusing on baselining this, understanding what this does, what all the accounts are there, the accounts that are used for X, Y, and Z. And we're going to set this other thing aside now. Would you move that into a priority based on the climate? If, and you can do any scenario, but like a climate-based scenario, how does that shift your priority?
So based on a lot of the supply chain attacks that we see that hit developers, developers are the people that are getting targeted, right? But the attack itself has a lot to do with how things are running. So I'd almost want to use who are developers, understand what endpoints do they touch. And then I'd want to baseline and profile those endpoints for behaviors, because we've seen a common trend for what execution looks like with some of these supply chain attacks when these repos and things get compromised and there's malicious stuff running. So because I feel comfortable with that, I feel like I'd have a better approach than trying to understand what their accounts do in general with off and whatever, because yes, there's a good chance that if they get hit with some of these things, there's a credential issue. But I feel like that's harder to run down because developers are doing a lot more random things versus the execution side of the house. There's some clear patterns that I would say are normal and not normal from a dev environment based on the purpose of a lot of the development. So I don't know if that makes sense to you. Kind of I frame that. I know I generalize a little bit, but.
From me and an experience, I can remember specific instances where your priorities are going to shift because of the climate for various reasons, especially even for things that shouldn't shift for, right? Like we know that all too well, like your priority gets shifted for something that somebody cares about that isn't critical. And, but it does, you know, kind of go to that point of you're kind of trying to sort through this ocean of stuff and trying to figure out, you know, the things you're going to do. And then you have to be ready to make those shifting points is kind of my thought process. Like I need to be ready to make that pivot because the climate's going to change and I'm going to need to refocus. However, there's a lot that you can do and think about when you kind of consider your processes in building these things that can make you more adaptable to those situations. Like you can create repeatable processes that allow you to just spin away from this focus over to this focus in this given area, right? So if you talk about accounts, you talk about like, what are the, you know, maybe leverage a data dictionary when I'm saying I want to baseline things in the realm of accounts, right? So I have my data dictionary creates that kind of repeatable flow process and focus points. And I just directionally point it at this segment of this grand account ocean, right? I don't know. It's just one way I think about it, but I know that it's a thing that has tripped me up before in the past because it's hard to take that switch of momentum, right? Like it's hard to adjust to that, especially if you don't have a really good baseline to start with, right? Mm-hmm. And you can't do it all, right? So when you start baseline, you can't do it all. You're not going to be able to. So don't try. Anybody out there that's going towards it, it's you hit a point a few minutes ago where you talked about, like, you know, somebody over here may have information that's already known. Like that I think is a mistake that I personally made in the past, where I just got so excited, or I just started digging, or I had a task and I just went into the data and I'm trying to recreate all the wheels. And it's like, okay, you don't need to do that. Like, just go talk to people, see who has what information, and then start where you need to go run on your own. Right.
Yeah. No, but it kind of made me think, like, I think a deliverable that'd be really good for someone to put out, or maybe we put it out, right, is it seems like every problem that we get faced as security professionals, and usually we can all be honest, there's very few people that are on a team and it's like, your job is the baseline, right? It's usually like the baseline would help your team, but there's no like, here's the baselining team, right? And when you describe, like, okay, what were the things you would baseline from an account perspective? Like, yeah, I'm thinking like holistically from what could do the most impact and what are usually the targets for things. And that's why I was like, well, I focus on these accounts and do that. And you're like, what about the developer thing? I thought that was a great segue, because basically what I'm doing is applying the same principles and picking from that menu list. Like, okay, the things I baseline, like, login activity as far as how things log in, what those look like, what's being executed. So there's like a list, but every time you present a new problem or focus, I need to be able to say, here's the list of things I know how to baseline and the purpose. And now I need to pick which thing is out of those lists address the issue I'm trying to address. And over time, you're kind of building a baseline across things. But I feel like the baselining approach is kind of how we should approach most of our security problems in general. So I think that process itself is more important than the baseline in a way, because you're not going to just have this library of baselines. No one really usually does.
I like the biggest win that comes from doing this successfully is you remove that the sky is falling effect when you have to.
Oh,
go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Exactly.
Like, it really gives you this fundamental grounding to where you can answer questions relatively quickly. You can apply this, what you've baselined, what data dictionaries you've built, this process or this repeatable, usable information, which is another point. I think we might've glanced over this. When you build this stuff, make sure it lives in a place that's immediately accessible. I think something note or a statement or a quote or something we had where it said something about, if you have a baseline or data dictionary and it can't immediately be used by someone in an IR situation at 2 a.m. in the morning, then it's not good enough and it's not in the right place. Like, that's something to consider, right? But I love that, like, if you can fundamentally get to some structure here, it starts really taking away that sky is falling. And I think any of us that are practitioners know what that feeling's like, and it sucks. It's awful. So, yeah, okay. So, like, go ahead. I'm sorry, Scott.
No, I was just going to say, like, so, you know, when some of the things we've listed, it really comes down to, like, I feel like there's almost like that, you know, this is a process and there should be like the specific bullet point questions. You should be able to ask yes, no to certain things. Does this apply? You know, what's the threat look like versus what are the things that you should consider knowing beforehand versus what are the things you're comparing to now? I feel like there's almost like a matrix that my brain's now chewing on as far as, like, it'd be cool somehow to help with that, right?
100%. And not like a template-based thing, but really more of a structure of, like, hey, you can attack it this way if you're thinking this. Attack it this way if you're thinking this. And here are things that you can build or dictionaries you can leverage to ground you. But let's say we have that. Let's say we have all of that in place and we're at the point now where we're going into the full throttle of, now we're going to start digging into the data, and you feel real sound about all of the stuff you brought in. You know, the security controls, you understand your policies, you understand your DR plans. You've talked to people, you understand what accounts are doing, what you have real good, strong base. I don't want to use that word twice. You have a real good foundation to attack building the baseline. Now you start digging in data. And the data throws its curveballs, because that's an absolute. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So now you know what things are supposed to be, but now you start diving into the data and it's a lot more than you expected. And there's a lot more things, a lot more noise, a lot of unanswered questions a lot of times, right? So you might go into it, start looking at your environment, thinking you have this really fundamentally sound vision of what it looks like, and the data is telling you a whole different story. What are some things you think of or thought process to flow you through that, like solving that issue?
Yeah, so I think it's like when we talk about threat hunting, we talk about, you know, visibility gaps is one of the values add because you discover that. I mean, when you're profiling or baselining, you're kind of doing like a hunt like structure and discovering similar things. So there's some things you just can't, like, you can't solve. Like, we just don't have the visibility for this. So then it becomes a, we put a pin in it and we figure out, is there a configuration that can address this? Is this just a known gap? So if it's a known gap, then you start looking at other places where we can maybe answer this question. So it kind of steers maybe your efforts a little bit. Or it becomes a, we just mark this gap because now it's like, hey, this is basically a risk we have to keep, we have to be aware of. And then you think, what's the downstream risks, the upstream risks, that kind of thing. So maybe there's a different place to address that by baselining something adjacent, baselining, you know, the next step.
You ready for the tough question?
Yeah.
So when you're in that, I'm sorry, I'm beating you up. It's just a really cool conversation. I'm sorry. I just love this conversation. It's cool to think about. You do the fundamental stuff and you work through the data and you massage the data. How do you, in that process, what you're talking about right now, what would you do to prevent blinding yourself? Because you'll go through this fundamental thing and you'll create these, I know this, but how do you make sure you don't get caught in that trap where you create some level of like an allow list or some kind of suppression mechanism or something that actually doesn't ever let you, or you basically shut a door and ever revisiting that stage again? How do you present that? Because I know that's a trap.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. People like, they look at something, it looks weird, and they immediately say, oh, this is normal based on what they know today. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like I've always been that on that, hey, if we're going to have logic that's going to, taking a step back, looking at like how detections and why this becomes a problem in the detection realm, right? Because you're like, hey, we see a lot of noise on this, but this is normal. So we add it to a whitelist and now that detection won't fire on that, right? I almost feel like sometimes there's benefit to having like the same detection and you have like your allowed list on the detection so you can kind of see how often it really hits and you kind of have like an automatic baselining happening, except for that's not alerting to anybody. It's just getting logged that it's happening. So then you can kind of revisit what you say is allowed with some side of cadence to say it's still doing the exact same thing it did 30 days ago and we still can see that it's normal activity, to kind of build more confidence based on those decisions. And then if it still is like but it's really, really privileged, maybe we still keep the same kind of monitoring in place, and because we know it can be a problem, or we can say, yeah, we've got enough confidence that this is controlled the right way, we're not going to worry about this, we'll worry about, you know, other things instead. But I always feel like there's ways to like, I never just like allow something and never look at it again. I always like put things in a holding pattern, if that makes sense.
But you typically, you want to create a trigger or something. Well, at least I would for myself. I'd want to create some kind of a trigger to make me directionally focus back to that. Like some kind of a health check alarm or a review process or something that lets me revisit my baseline to make sure that I'm still as sound as I was. Right. And as you're building your baseline, if I'm thinking about this out loud right now, like you can inherently set checks to just redo that to make sure, like you could almost automate a health check in it to say, okay, these things still matter. You could create triggers potentially depending on the data set that says, okay, well, I need to consider this, or maybe there is a side thing that's collecting data that is continuously looking to update that baseline. You know, now my brain's going on 100 ideas. Thanks, Scott.
Well, like, you know, it's funny because the things you typically allow are the things that usually are pretty stable or allowed. And so what's interesting is that's where, not saying it's necessarily the tried and true approach, but it doesn't hurt to put thresholds on something like that from a, hey, this happens all the time, that's why we whitelisted it, but like, does it consistently hit the same number? Did it ever fall off that number? Why did it fall off? Did something go down? Did something change? You know, that kind of stuff. So there's like a little bit of that. You know, and it's, you know, but I remember even instances where we had some platforms that were like doing ping discovery, but we had segmented network environment and we had really critical network environments that weren't supposed to talk to other network environments. So naturally the firewalls are working and is blocking just discovery ping type activity. But, you know, if something lands in the environment, that might be a way where attackers try to discover what's around them. And you're like, talk to the people that own the asset, and you're like, well, it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. You're like, I understand it's supposed to discover, but it's not supposed to discover here, right? And they're like, well, no, but it's not like hurting anything. It's like, no, but then if I can fix the problem, because sometimes that might be the solution, is you can get whoever to say, can we configure this not to do this behavior? Because if it's a failing instance, right? If it's a success instance, you know, you got to tolerate it because it's doing what it's supposed to be doing and it's successful. Ideally. But if something is failing, and then you're like, either something's broken or it shouldn't be doing it, that sometimes can be remediated without having to like find a workaround yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's also those buckets to consider when dealing with those types of like what you would allow from a baseline perspective.
Yeah, and I think the why should, all the way back to the very beginning of it, the why should help anchor this. Because if you're baselining and it's in the baseline of the dictionary you're building, or this layout, this functional use is applied to a SOC, it's going to be a little bit different than threat hunting, right? Like you have to consider different things, right? Like as a really easy example, if you're baselining and leveraging this against like how the gate in front of your SOC is working, you don't want to whitelist or put something as a don't pay attention to it because you're having to deal with 10,000 false positives all day because the configuration thing hasn't been taken care of. So you don't want to like shelf it and then forget it's there because you did it for this point in time because it was overloading your SOC.
Right.
Whereas like a threat hunter could easily just disregard those based on the notation of what's happening. They can understand how to apply that in the process from that baseline note, right? So the why still matters to that degree too.
Yeah, it's interesting because like how people, the purpose of why you allow something really kind of functions on your task or your job.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dealing with live alerts, you have to allow more than you would want versus like threat hunting, you would allow less, for instance. So,
yep.
But they have different tolerances, I guess, just to say. So it's a call out. But yeah, so I mean, to kind of sum up, because we're kind of coming, down to the end, is we did talk about like what to baseline to some degree. So like, and we talked about a matrix might be a good approach to this, but from like a baseline card of this key things, if you actually have some things documented, it's good to understand what entity you're looking at. And we talked about accounts, we've talked about endpoints, we talked about application. We didn't talk a ton about infrastructure, but I would say the key piece there is, if you have defined or segmentation going on in your environment, you know kind of how things communicate or should learn some of those things. Because even like a web apps talk to databases on a backend. Sometimes they don't even live on the same system. Sometimes there's an intermediary between there. So you know that nothing should directly talk to the database except for through this mean or whatever, right? So understanding those from an infrastructure perspective are great baselining approaches. But you get the measures, either frequency, volume, cardinality, timing, relationship, or the sequencing sometimes. You look at the population on that baseline card as far as you're comparing it to itself, its peer, some sort of global thing based on how you understand whatever the purpose is. What does a window or refresh rate look like if you need to revisit something? Because it comes up again as far as you want to do more threat hunting on this topic or in this environment. Then some of the legitimate drivers for some of the things you had to consider, like internal processes, what could be shown with that. We talked about the five different shapes. Sometimes you can categorize them in so that when you do see behavioral changes, like when we talked about bursty, there's like a burst, like, well, it does that historically, right? So now we know not to completely freak out, but we know, okay, it's bursty and this is the characteristics of those bursts, right? So, and then prescribed versus observed. Any closing thoughts from you, Tom, before we kind of close this out officially?
The honest to true self thoughts. I want to start building something because I'm all excited. We could probably talk about this for another 3 hours. There's so much stuff there. But this is a good start. Hopefully it's beneficial to everyone that's listening. And yeah, this is such a good topic, and it's time well spent in practice for anyone who hasn't yet or goes through the troubles of this. Like, we've experienced it too, but the benefit absolutely exists in this. Like, yeah. I'll stop there, or I'm going to keep going for another hour.
No, you're good. So, yeah, I appreciate everybody joining. Hopefully there's some value add. And obviously, if there's topics or things that you want us to dig into on future episodes, feel free to reach out to either Tom or I. LinkedIn's a great place to reach us with the message. We'll definitely try to see what we can address or just, you know, chew on for a while. But yeah, thanks again for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast, our live edition. Hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.